This episode of the Everything Matters podcast is brought to you by BeLegendary.coach, where we transform leaders into legends. Are you a senior leader, entrepreneur, or executive looking to take your leadership to the next level? Are you dealing with things such as imposter syndrome, concerns with whether or not your leadership is lingering long after you've completed FaceTime, looking for new and innovative ways to connect with your team and to gain buy-in from stakeholders that you deal with on a daily basis? If any of this sounds like something that you're dealing with and you would like to take your leadership to an extraordinary level, your effectiveness to a legendary level, visit BeLegendary.coach. That's www.BeLegendary.coach and schedule your free performance analysis today. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the next episode of the Everything Matters podcast, podcast episode number 32. Hey, if you're liking the content that we're sharing, please click the like button, subscribe to the channel, and share it out to the world so that they can actually get the benefit as well. This helps us grow. It helps the algorithms to know that our content is being liked and helps us get this message out to the world. So thank you for sharing it. My special guest today is Julie Thomas. Julie is the president and CEO of Value Selling Associates Incorporated. Julie works with revenue leaders across many industries to help them realize results that they never thought were truly possible. Julie is passionate about guiding revenue organizations through uncertain times and helping them to build resilient and engaged teams that drive predictable, sustainable results and create customers for life. This particular framework is Coach B approved, as I've had the personal pleasure of working closely with Julie and the value selling team and recently ascertained the coveted certification of being a value selling framework facilitator and coach. So if you're a revenue leader out there and you're looking for a highly effective methodology or framework that, if followed as directed, will yield consistent sales performance and lasting customer relationships, please consider taking a look at Julie's company and the incredible team of professionals that she has who help push this out to the world. Julie, welcome to the Everything Matters podcast. Let's get it popping. Julie Thomas, welcome to the Everything Matters podcast. Julie, it has been probably almost, well, I won't say a year, not been that bad, but it's been at least 6 months plus since we've been able to trying to get this interview on the docket. So thank you so much for being here today. I know you got tons of stuff going on, and you know, we were talking about a little bit off camera how crazy the market is right now and trying to juggle 15, 20 balls at once. So I know how busy you are, and I want to thank you for being here today and coming and share with us your story and talking to us about value selling associates in your life. So welcome.
Awesome. Thanks, Bradford. And thanks for keeping on me. I'm glad we were able to finally make it happen. I'm thrilled to be a part of your conversation this morning.
Awesome. Thank you, Julie. So as I always start off these interviews, Julie, I want to give the audience an opportunity to know who you are. I know who you are. You and I have got a chance to spend some time together in a workshop that I attended with your company. And I want to give the audience an opportunity to know who you are, where you're from. So talk to us, Julie. Where'd you grow up? Where are you from now? What have your travels been like? Just kind of let us know a little bit about you personally, and then we'll get into some of the business stuff as we move along.
Awesome. Thank you. Well, you know, I grew up in the Midwest, was born in St. Paul, Minnesota, and early in my childhood, my parents split up. This was a long time ago. This was before that was nearly as prevalent, unfortunately, as it is today. And I had a working mom who had to work to take care of my sister and I. And she went and started working for the airlines. She started with Northwest Airlines at the time as a reservationist and worked the night shift. So she'd work like 3 to 11. We lived close to a college campus. We had a young nursing student move into our home and was kind of the nanny, if you will.
Wow.
And, but my mom, it was important to my mom to be home with us as much as she could during the day. So that worked out well. The plus side of having her work for the airlines was we got great benefits. And so I kind of grew up being an airline brat. And lo and behold, my mom remarried when I was in junior high, and we moved to Connecticut, would go back to Minnesota at least twice a year to spend some time with my father and grandparents and the rest of my family. But totally grew up an airline brat and got that travel bug early.
Nice.
went to college, started my career in sales, and I would say I became an accidental entrepreneur. So I was in sales leadership for a number of years, primarily with a company called Gartner Group in the tech services industry. Okay. And we brought in this trainer by the name of Lloyd Sappington, and he taught us this thing called value selling. Well,
Don't go there yet. Hold on. Let's save the goodies. Don't quite go there yet. I don't want you to spill the goodies yet. Okay. I want to still talk about this cold climate you and your mom apparently love. You went from Minnesota to Connecticut. It's like jumping out of the skillet into the frying pan, we say it when I grew up. You know, I know where you live now, which is nothing like that, right? Yeah. So how did you escape the cold climate of Connecticut, Minnesota, and all of that?
So I was living in Connecticut. I had bounced around New England early in my career, lived in Boston for a number of years back in Connecticut, where I met my husband, now husband. And he took a job in San Diego, California, which is where I am now, almost 26 years ago. And we were engaged at the time. And I was fortunate that my current provider allowed me to just transfer. So I was working remote before working remote was cool, if you will, and moved here to San Diego 25 years ago. And here we will stay. We raised our family here. Our kids are Southern California babies. They don't know what a mudroom is. They don't know why you would have to put on boots. As a matter of fact, the elementary school that my kids went to didn't even have a lunchroom because every day they ate outside at picnic tables.
And California kids, life, I tell you. California life.
They grew up complaining if it was a rainy day and they would have to eat lunch in their classroom. And I'm like, you have no idea what real life is like for most people in the world. So
exactly.
So here we are in San Diego and and actually have another place. We're splitting our time a little bit between South Carolina. So our blood has thinned. We are staying in the warm weather.
I heard that. I don't blame you. South Carolina is one of my favorite places, too. I think we talked about that when I was out there visiting with you in San Diego. I lived in Charleston for a short period. And man, I absolutely loved it. Love the beaches there. The people are great. The culture, the food, the architecture is gorgeous. The history, just a beautiful place. So next time you're down in South Carolina, you got to invite me down.
I will. And that's where we're going. We're headed to Charleston. So
I love it. I love it. Love it. So I want to go back to you were talking about when you moved to Connecticut. So where were you when you took on that first sales job? And tell us again who the company was that you worked for and how did that even come about? Like what made you want to, like most people get out of college, the last thing they want to do is sell something, right? Nobody's trying to sell anything. That's, you know, you don't want to be seen as a sleazy car salesman person. And although there's a ton of money, excuse my language, there's a shitload of money making sales, but nobody wants to go to it. So what drew you into going into a sales career?
So it was interesting. So when I went to college, my favorite class my freshman year was economics. Okay. And my stepfather, who was a American Airlines captain pilot by day and had ran a CPA business by night. Many pilots have two jobs because their profession affords them that ability. So he was also a CPA. He told me at the time, hey, Julie, if you love economics, what you really need to do is transfer into the College of Business and major in finance, because it doesn't matter what you're going to do in your life. You need to understand accounting and finance. And it was probably one of the most formative pieces of advice I got in my life.
Yeah.
Transferred to the business school, and I did end up with a degree in finance. So my first job out of school was a finance job.
Okay.
And I worked for an oil company, hated it. Not because I just hated the work. I hated the culture at the time of this company where I was essentially punching the clock and, you know, working, and I was doing what they called crude oil accounting. I mean, it couldn't have been more boring to me.
Right.
So after my 2 years, cause I kind of felt I had to pay penance for 2 years, and on my 2 year anniversary, I quit, moved back to Connecticut. Okay. And I got a job working for Gartner Group. At the time, the company was very small. It was only about 10 years old in the research and advisory space for the computer industry, for technology.
Okay.
And I was an accountant. So I got a job in what was in an accounting department. It was called sales support and billing. So I was doing the order entry into the system of all the orders that the salespeople did. And one of the things that our group did was calculate commissions.
Commission. I knew that was coming.
And I became friends with a bunch of these salespeople because I was working with them and I'm calculating their commissions saying, what the heck? I am pretty sure I can do what they do. And so I used to tell our VP of sales, like pass them in the hallway and say, I'm your next top performer. When are you going to give me my shot in sales? After 6 months, he basically came up to me and said, okay, put your money where your mouth is. And he moved me into an inside sales job.
Okay.
So I was supporting two or three outside reps.
Uh-huh.
We were doing continuous services. So, you know, it was long before SaaS was a thing. And so in my role, I was responsible for renewals.
Okay.
As well as potentially identifying upsell, cross-sell opportunities within these accounts.
Got it.
After 6 months, I was the top inside sales rep measured by retention, as well as some of the upsell opportunities I'd uncovered. And they promoted me into outside sales. And I moved to Boston. Absolutely. Did it 4 years, then moved back into some leadership positions and bounced around. Actually met my husband while I was a sales rep. I made a sales call on him.
I heard that.
It's the biggest deal I've ever closed and the most valuable one.
No doubt about it.
And here we are.
That's awesome. Awesome. Met your husband on a sales call. That's crazy. So you worked in sales. It sounds like you were in some leadership roles, some individual contributor roles, sort of just learning sales, right? So how did the opportunity, let's move into sort of your career going to the next level, if you will, and really getting into entrepreneurship. How long of a career did you have in sales leadership, training and development, or whatever you did around sales before you actually stumbled across this opportunity to purchase Value Selling? And I know that you're the CEO of Value Selling right now, but you weren't the founder. So I'd love to hear that story. You and I talked about that. So how did you come across Value Selling Associates, and how did that whole trans? I know it's an interesting story. I sort of remember pieces of it that you told me. What was it? How did that transpire? How did it come about?
So awesome. So the founder of Value Selling was a gentleman by the name of Lloyd Sappington, and Gartner Group was one of his first clients. And he was really a solopreneur.
Okay.
Kind of a single shingle guy, had come out of Xerox, had been one of the first trainers of spin at Xerox Computer Systems, certified by Neil Rackham way back in the day. And over time, he recognized there was some opportunities to build on spin and some gaps in his thinking. So he went on to create this thing called Value Selling. And he sold it to Gartner. So in that, he was the consultant that would show up. He was my Rick McInnish. So I've built a relationship with him. And my last job at Gartner was what you would now call the head of sales enablement. We were growing rapidly. I was in, we called it at the time, associate development, but I was responsible for sales training, onboarding, participated in recruiting, but reported directly to the head of sales because he believed firmly that whoever was enabling the salespeople had to really understand the field, had to have been in the field to appreciate the complexity of sales. So in that role, then I became Lloyd's biggest customer.
Okay.
And he lives in San Diego. So you can imagine when we moved out here, he's the only person I knew in San Diego. I called him. Can you introduce me to a realtor? Can you give me the lay of the land where, here's what we're thinking. Where should we live?
Right.
And through that, he actually welcomed my husband and I into his social circle. And we became really good friends.
Nice.
Fast forward, he's ready to retire. Gartner's going through some leadership changes. And I was given the option to either move back to Connecticut or sever from the company. And I chose the latter. And I approached Lloyd to become one of the trainers at Value Selling. We'd done Train the Trainer at Gartner. I understood the methodology. I believed in the methodology. And he basically took myself and my husband out to dinner and said, I have a different idea. I really want to play golf every day. He was in his mid-60s. He was looking to wind down his career. And we put together a plan. I came into the organization with a plan to for him to phase out, for me to phase in. And we actually acquired the organization from him over the next couple of years. And I've been leading it. It'll be my 20th anniversary as CEO of Value Selling this July.
Congratulations. I mean, you know, owning a company and working inside of a company, anything for 20 years is a huge accomplishment. So congratulations to that, Julie. So one of the things you mentioned earlier that I want to give people who may not have been around the sales world for a long time, you mentioned spin. And I remember one of my first jobs, I think I was exposed to the spin methodology. Just give people sort of an idea of what spin is and how it sort of dovetails into the value selling methodology and maybe some similarities. I know you said that Lloyd saw some gaps there, which is how he developed value selling. So just give everybody a quick sense of what spin is or was.
So back, I believe it was in the late 60s, early 70s, Xerox Computer Systems hired this gentleman by the name of Neil Rackham. He wasn't a sales specialist. He was a behavioral psychologist. Mm-hmm. And they asked him, hey, can you follow our salespeople and help us figure out what's the difference between our high performers and everybody else?
Well, don't we all want to know that?
we're still trying to figure that out, right?
Right.
But he followed that. And the conclusion that he came up with was high performing sales reps ask better, different, and more questions than the rest of the pack. The rest of the pack is showing up and kind of throwing up, talking about product, dumping capabilities, and the high performers were asking questions, making connections, and building deeper relationships. And the four areas that he identified that they're asking questions on, he called were situation, which is the S in spin,
right?
Problems, implication, and need. So he developed this spin process based on observation to create a rudimentary questioning cadence around those four things. You need to understand the situation. You need to understand what problems they have. You need to understand the implications of those problems. And you need to understand what they think they need.
Yes.
And thus, he wrote the book Spin. Xerox kind of launched it. And that was kind of one of the, I mean, you could argue that the first generation of sales questioning techniques was really Dale Carnegie.
Yes.
Who wrote the book many years before that, How to Win Friends and Influence People. Guess what?
Right.
Ask them a question. And then Spin kind of took it to that business to business level. And then almost every methodology since Spin has built on, improved, and developed or refined that framework. And value selling was one of those solutions.
Great story. Really great story. You know, I was just thinking as you were breaking down what spin is, I'm thinking, man, if I could apply spin to my marriage, if I could apply spin to my relationship with my kids and my friends, man, it'd probably make a world of difference, right? Now, when you really look at those four components, right? It really hasn't changed a whole lot. The businesses have got more complicated with technology and things that have become, but really you need to always understand the situation that customers are dealing with. It's always important, right? What are the problems that they have? I mean, we're always looking to uncover problems because that's how you can connect your solutions to their problems. And then it's like, you know, the implications, you know, what's the pain that people are feeling by the problems that they're having? So Barry, I love that being a core idea behind really the psychology of how people buy. And you pointed out one of those things that about the Gong research that they did. And it's one of the slides that's in your facilitation deck that they evaluated. I think it was over 550 some odd thousand calls on Gong. And in that evaluation, they did discover that same behavior that the high performing people who closed the biggest and the most valuable deals were those who asked the most questions. And how can you really understand the situation unless you ask questions? How can you really understand the problems and implications unless you ask questions? And I saw this early on in my career. I'd see where people, you know, some people just talk all the time. And now we have actually, you know, ways that we can measure how much you talk and how much time you spend asking questions in a sales interaction, which I think is one of the most brilliant tools we could ever have. So I love that way that you created that for us to give us a sense of what spin is and how it sort of dovetails into value selling. So I want to dive into value selling while we're there. Like, so what did he uncover and what are some of the differences that with value selling, we've been able to sort of fill in those gaps to make it more effective than spin and really take spin to a whole new level? Tell us about that.
Absolutely. So there were a couple things that Lloyd believed were critical to understand. And number one is, yes, I need to understand the problems, but not all problems in a business-to-business environment are worth solving. Mm. There are some problems that customers will live with, and there are some problems that will get resource, energy, cash to solve. So he added the layer of not only just understanding the problems, but connecting those problems to real business outcomes or business objectives that matter, which many technical sales reps and technology sales reps really wrestle with. They want to solve technical problems with their technical solution, and they struggle with the translation to a real business outcome. So that was one of the first gaps he identified. The second gap is, and if you think about it, and today it's even more important than ever before, you need to really understand who's involved in the buying decision and what their role is. You know, by some accounts, depending on the size of the solution that you sell, there could be anywhere from 8, 10, 15 people involved in that decision. And you need to understand how to navigate those people, how to build consensus among those people, how to identify both the process and the individuals around them, gain access, maintain access to those people. And that is one of the a big complexity for that salespeople struggle with today, because at the end of the day, you cannot sell to someone who cannot buy.
It's true. So true.
So that's one of the areas. And then there's a couple other subtleties, but I would say one of the third big components that Lloyd built on, and you probably see this in your own organization, the challenge for most sales leaders and sales reps for that matter is being able to predict when business will close. And I've never met a sales rep today who doesn't have to do some sort of a forecast.
Absolutely.
Either the forecast is automatically derived from their CRM based on the data they put in, or they have to sit down with their manager and say, hey, A, B, and C are going to close. D, I'm not so sure about, right? So they go through that process. So we built in a deliberate framework to work with customers in identifying when are they actually going to buy and how are they going to buy. And we do that by focusing them on the outcomes and the value realized they expect from the partnership and then back into that. So it's a real powerful technique and a critical component to the value selling framework methodology.
So good. I mean, I got you here and I'm just thinking to myself, man, I need to share this interview with our team, because Julie's giving us all the nuggets here. You're hearing it from the horse's mouth. I've been around this stuff for 2 decades plus. Right. So one of the questions I get, Julie, a lot, and I want to just throw it out there to you from our sales organization is, it's the quantification piece. Like, they struggle sometimes with quantifying, you know, number one, problems that, and I love how you put this, problems that are worth solving. Like, who is this problem big enough to and important enough to that they're willing to even reallocate budget that they had to put over here? And now they're like, you know what? On second thought and third thought, we're going to put this money over here. Like, so how do you, you know, what are some of the ways that you'd say are most effective in being able to quantify value for customers inside of this framework?
So there's a couple of things, and I want to step back and kind of position a little bit about how I think about that.
Okay.
Most companies, and Hootsuite is no exception, have what they call a value proposition. Here is the potential value that our customers will derive when they implement our solutions.
Yes.
It's a broad promise to the marketplace, if you will. Yes. The difference in value selling is taking that and understanding, hey, for this specific client, how are they going to make the decision that the investment that I'm going to ask them to make as a sales rep, and yes, I am going to ask you to spend some money with me if I'm in sales, is more or is less than what I expect to get. So everybody's kind of always going through this, is it worth it conversation?
Yes.
In our world, there's two ways to measure, is it worth it? There's the return on investment, and we'll talk about that in a second.
Okay.
But there's also the cost of inaction. So there's ROI and there's COI. And the best value quantification is often a combination of those two components. Mm. So what am I going to get as a result of investing in you? Maybe I'm going to get more productive. Maybe I'm going to accelerate my time to market. And the sales rep has to identify what those metrics are,
right,
that are measurable, that they can help the customer quantify. Cost of inaction might be, in your world, it might be the cost of having individuals manually do something, mm-hmm, because we haven't automated yet. Well, right, what happens when you manually do something? A, it takes time. B, there could be mistakes, because people are people and we are imperfect beings, right?
Right?
So how can I quantify, hey, how much time is it taking somebody to do this? How often is there a problem or a mistake or an inaccuracy, or the post didn't go at the time or the way you expected it to go? And what did that cost you? What did that cost you in dollars if you had to redo it? What did that cost you in reputation, mm-hmm, if it was a negative reflection on the company or the brand?
Right.
And we combine those. So the best value sellers are the ones that don't just go after one KPI or one metric, but they expand the conversation to get multiple metrics to build this value prop out to try to make it a no-brainer of an investment. Now, one thing that is a challenge, I think, in today's world, and you can argue what the economy, I'm not an economist, I transferred to finance, but there are some headwinds that most of are facing. And I think today there's two sales that every sales rep has to justify. I need to win in my category. Like, I have to prove that I'm the most valuable solution,
right,
for the problems you're looking to solve and win in that. But I also have to have a strong enough value confirmation or business case that when the sales leader, in my case, goes to the boardroom to get the capital to make this investment, and he's fighting against maybe an engineering solution,
right,
that there's enough value that not only is the best in the category, but stands on its own in competing projects for capital. Because, mm-hmm, everybody can only do so much at one time.
Right. You know, one of the things you mentioned too, and that's just a really brilliant comparison there. One of the things you mentioned also was you know, being able to talk to people who can actually make the decision, right? And this is where a lot of salespeople struggle is, you know, they'll say, well, Coach B, you know, I'm you know, the people that I'm talking to, they don't know the information. Like, they don't know the measurement or the financial impact of, you know, of not having the solution, right? Or of having the solution. And so it's hard to quantify to the people that, and I'm like, you're right, you're talking to the wrong people. So, you know, what are some just couple nuggets you can give us, and, you know, how to, and you mentioned earlier about gaining access to power and maintaining access to power. And I know there's some strategies that you have, but, you know, you have several high performing salespeople, Chad and Rick are two of them on your team. You know, what's been really effective? You could just drop one or two nuggets for any sales professionals out there listening of how to gain access to power, people who actually make a decision, who can strike a check, and how do you maintain that relationship and keep it open so you can continue to grow that and stay connected to that individual or those individuals in many cases? What would you let us know? What would you tell us?
So there's a couple of things. So first of all, if I'm having this conversation with someone and they share, you know, I'm not sure I know the answers to those questions.
Right.
Sometimes it's just pausing and saying, well, at some point, someone in the organization is going to be making some decisions around that. Who are those people? And how can I help you and partner with you to get the right information in front of them and to facilitate those conversations. I think one thing that some sales reps, it's a blind spot that gets in their own way, is they're so afraid of insulting or annoying the person they do have access to. Agreed. They fail to say, hey, we're in this together. How can you move from a gatekeeper to a bridge builder?
Yes.
And then one of the tactics are, how can I negotiate for access to those ultimate decision makers with the person who might be the gatekeeper and turn them into that bridge builder with valuable resources that are going to help me shorten the sales cycle? So if you're telling me, Bradford, that you don't have the answer to those questions and how they're going to justify this investment, then and then at the same time, you're asking me for demos or trials or free anything or a site visit or access to pricing, I'm going to hold that back until I can get what I need and bargain with you to advance that sales cycle. But the first step is acknowledging that I'm at risk of not working with the ultimate decision makers.
Absolutely.
And figuring out a path to access.
I love it. I love it. I totally agree. One thing you mentioned that it's one of the things that I always coach on is having people see for themselves that you're not a salesperson here. You're a partner. So when you can create partnership with a potential prospect, that's something different. They start to see you as someone who's working with them, because a lot of times in a sales position, people see you as working against them. You're trying to get money out of their budget. You're trying to get money out of their pocket. And yeah, that's true. But in a partnership situation, you're more willing to loosen your purse straps, if you will, and offer that as something. Hey, you know what? We're in this together. Let me see what I could put together to help us out here, right? And so partnership is something I hear ringing very strongly with you. And also, you know, you mentioned you got to first acknowledge it, right? It's a blind spot. You're right. And a lot of times this whole idea about I don't want to piss somebody off, or I don't want to annoy somebody, or I don't want to get on their nerves, or I don't want to make them feel invaluable, has little to do with you, right? That's all in how that's happening for them over there. But that should have no bearing on whether or not you ask the question. Because if you don't ask the question, you got to be looking at you. And okay, why am I not willing to ask this question? What is it that's going on with me that I'm got this anxiety about me, this angst that won't let me say these words out of my mouth? That's a whole different coaching conversation. And most times that's really what's going on, because it's not a matter of them knowing what to say or knowing what to do. It's the will to do it. So what is that that's got you stopped in making and taking the action that you know is going to get you the result you want? It's a coaching opportunity. So that's really brilliant. I love how you position that, because it's something I think every salesperson struggles with, you know, just about everybody on some level or another. Some don't struggle as much, but it's there for a lot of people. So thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, and it's, you know, I've never talked to a sales rep who says, hey, I don't want to be the trusted advisor. I want to be more than a vendor or more than a supplier. Yeah. Well, how do you do that? You add value every interaction you have. Think of the people that you like and trust. They're the people that you also believe like and trust you. They lean into the relationship. It's not just about them. And that's why sales reps get that bad rap that you alluded to. It's because it doesn't matter what your agenda is, Bradford. My agenda is to get you to buy something. I don't care if you need it or not. I just need your money in my pocket.
Right.
But I don't think I've never met sales reps that really operate that way. That's not what we're thinking. If we have the confidence that whatever we're selling is going to enrich your life, enrich your company, and add positive value, we should also have the competence that we can have those conversations with the right people to make it happen.
Yeah, so agree. Really well said, Julie. Awesome. So a couple more questions and we're going to bring this thing to a wrap. This has been really good, really good. So what are you seeing out there in the minute? We talked about this a little bit before we started the interview. You know, there's a lot of things that are going on out there, right? And being in this business and owning this business for 20 plus years, just making your 20 year anniversary, I'm sure you've seen a lot. I mean, that would include the meltdown of 08, 09 that you actually navigated your way through. That would also include whatever is going on right now in the economy, I think no one really has any earthly clue what the hell is going on unless you're a high level economist. There's a lot of things. And you mentioned the word uncertainty. You know, for you, for one, and then for anyone who's out there navigating a company in this particular environment, what have been some of the things that have sustained you and allowed you to be able to maneuver through these, you know, these turbulent times and these times of uncertainty successfully?
I love it. And we do talk about turbulent times. And I mean, and you didn't even mention the granddaddy of them all, which is I'm in the training business and we weren't allowed to travel or be in room with our customers, you know, for a good chunk of time there. And I'm in California. So, you know, it was as restrictive as anywhere on the planet, if
yes.
you will.
Yeah.
So I think there's a couple of things. Number one, companies have to be agile so they can take advantage of opportunities as they present themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think it was our agility that allowed us to survive in 2008. That, I mean, every 7 or 8 years, it seems like we have some economic force that changes things. It was year 2000, and then it was 2008 with the housing meltdown that had ripples everywhere. And then now the pandemic and you know, some of the other uncertain things, both financially, economically, geopolitically, that we're all facing. So agility, I think, is really important. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I think happens, and you know, let's face it, sales is hard. It's hard to get people's attention.
It is.
Business people are busy. No one wants to meet with the sales rep unless it's their choice, not the sales rep's choice. And I think in these uncertain, turbulent times, companies and decision makers become more risk averse. It is safer to do nothing than stick my neck out and make a change. And sales reps have to recognize that and help mitigate the risk in purchase decisions and ensure that the buyer is confident and can predict the outcomes. One of the influencers that I read a lot from, and he's been a client of ours over the years, is a gentleman by the name of Todd Capone. And he says, people don't buy when they're convinced. They buy when they can predict, when they have certainty in the outcomes that they can expect. And I think sales reps really have to work hard to paint that picture and build that confidence that they know exactly what those outcomes are going to be when they make a change to a new supplier or bring in a new product or change their own processes, et cetera.
Yeah, so true. So true. And it doesn't matter what level of the business that you're in, right? Everybody's dealing with those same concerns and considerations. No question about it.
Absolutely.
Manager level, front lines to the boardrooms. Everybody's got these concerns because nobody, especially now, I think after 2020, and I don't know how I could actually overlook that. You brought it to my attention. Thank you. I mean, that was huge impact on everybody in every level. And I think one of the statistics shows that, you know, before 2020, you know, you might have 4 or 5 people that might be involved in a decision. Now it's like it could be upwards of 10, 12, 13, 14 people that are looking at something before budget's released to actually buy something. So it goes right into, like you said, it's safer to just stay put because if I make this decision and put mine, I got a couple of friends of mine that are in executive level positions and we talk about this kind of stuff and they're like, dude, I mean, I'm consulting with consultants from the outside. I'm talking to economists, all kinds of people before I make any move to spend any significant resources. So your point is well taken. Very well, very well said.
Well, and that's a risk mitigation strategy. If I can get more smart people buying into the decision, then I've got maybe greater confidence. But you hit on something. You know, we've always talked about the buying committee getting larger and larger. But pre-pandemic, so much business was still happening face-to-face and in a conference room. Mm-hmm. And if, Bradford, if you were out of town, you just didn't go to that meeting. Well, we're all so comfortable now with virtual meetings that doesn't happen. So then why not involve other stakeholders? Because we're expanding how we do work. And you know what? That genie's out of the bottle. It's not going back.
Sure isn't. No time soon. Well, great. Julie, I want to ask you, this is kind of on a personal level. You know, we move away from selling and sales. And man, so much great value that you offered. I really appreciate that. And I think there's going to be a ton of people that get a lot of value out of this, especially people who are in sales leadership. So y'all need to listen to this episode. Two questions here. Number one, who inspires you? And number two, how do you see yourself playing a part and a role in having a positive impact with inspiring our youth, maybe even inspiring them into going into like a sales career or something like that, or training and development or enablement? What do you say about that?
Awesome. I love it. Who inspires me? I think there's a couple people that inspire me. For sure, my parents. My dad actually is a sales, well, he's a retired sales professional.
Okay.
My mom was a single mom who made it happen and provided for us. And even though they haven't been married for, I don't know, 55 years,
right,
they both were very formative in my life and they inspired me. I got my work ethic from them. They afforded me the opportunity to get the education that I got and those types of things.
Outstanding.
But more recently, what inspires me is my customers. Mm. It is a hoot, no pun intended, a ton of fun to watch the fire be ignited in sales professionals. Mm. And then really for us to be the catalyst for people to achieve results they never thought were possible by following our framework. And it is a high, it is a rush. I love it. So it's our customers and the success that they have that lights a fire under me every single day. You know, as for the youth type, you know, question, it's interesting because more and more universities are starting to incorporate sales into their curriculum. For years, it was just like maybe a class under marketing, but there are certain universities now that actually have sales. You can major in sales or get a certificate in sales or that.
Right.
I'm involved in a couple of universities at that level.
Okay.
University of Michigan, and then my alma mater, the University of Colorado, where they have, they bring in professionals from industry, sales leaders, sales professionals, people like myself, and we get to mentor students.
Nice.
And that has been a ton of fun. And also at Colorado, we give a couple of, we do two different scholarships at the University of Colorado. Again, it's my alma mater, so it's where my heart is. But we give two scholarships annually to business students that show an interest in the sales professional. And I've been really proud to meet some of those individuals. And that is really my heart. It's a noble, sales is a noble profession.
100%.
I did not expect to be in sales. And I certainly didn't expect to be an influencer in the sales industry and running a company helping people improve their sales, but I wouldn't have it any other way. I absolutely love it.
I love it. I love it. Really great stuff. And thank you for all the work you're doing at the University of Colorado and helping these young people and offering the scholarships that you all are doing. This really great stuff. You know, I want to give a shout out to my boy, Robert, you know, who was instrumental in making me go into sales. I was doing a regular job. I think I was managing restaurants or something. And he kept telling me, dude, you need to get into sales. A lot of money in sales, a lot of money in sales. And I finally took the leap and I've been in and around sales for the remainder of my career, the last 20 plus years. So I'm so thankful for that opportunity. And I agree with you. I think that when, you know, after you've made money and you've done all those things and all that's great, right? And you got a good career, you got a nice home and all those material things. And you start to really settle down in your career. You get to realize the difference that you're able to make with your customers and how you are able to impact their lives. Like, you know, one of the things you talk about in that that's part of the value selling framework is personal value. Right? How does it impact this person individually? Like, does it free up time for them to go to their daughter's softball game on Saturdays now because they're not having to work, you know, on the weekends? Does it free up another date night for them because they can get out of the office at 5 o'clock versus 7 o'clock at night? Like, those are the things that if salespeople, I think, will look at it from that perspective and how they're able to serve their customers, how they're able to benefit their lives, impact their lives in a positive way, it might become a little bit less like selling and more like just helping other people, which I think we're all inspired to do on some level or another, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. It is fun when you can participate in other people's success. And, you know, we use the word that we're the catalyst. Like, you know, we can help you ignite that in your organization and then allow you to take it forward and realize those results. And impact people's lives, not just the companies they work for.
Absolutely. And y'all have certainly done that at Hootsuite. So I thank you, Rick, Chad, and all the value selling team who's made such a difference in our organization and continue to make a difference, you know, on a consistent basis. So thank you for all you do. This has been a wonderful interview. Julie, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. You know, I'm going to invite you to come back again another time. And all the value that you provided here, it's maybe a good segment to have you come on for 15 minutes and just talk about something about value selling and how we can help people get results in their sales careers. So thank you for being here. Great stuff.
I love it. I welcome the opportunity, Bradford.
Awesome. Well, come back and see us again, Julie. Take care. And again, thank you so much for coming and being on the podcast and being my guest today.
Thanks for having me. Have a great afternoon.
My pleasure. You too.
This is Doris Brown's baby boy. We out.